Okay, moving on to another easy issue. On Iran, should the United States reject the nuclear agreement with Iran, and what would be the consequences of doing that? George?
The consequence, the answer is no. The consequence of doing this would be that the United States would hope that it could snap back sanctions and all the rest, but the rest of the world would be unimpressed. Iran is a wonderful market for all kinds of things, and the world is clamoring to get in and participate. I'm not as exercised about this issue as some because I'm a defeatist on the issue. That is, I think any nation that wants nuclear weapons really badly is going to get them. The Iranians have been pouring enormous amounts of energy and wealth into this project for at least a generation and a half. It's going to be another case where we're going to have to come to terms with a nuclear power that will require us to contain and deter them until, we hope, regime change comes about. But that's not impossible.
Michelle?
I'm not a complete defeatist. So on this issue, I think that it's very important to keep the Iran deal in place. Everybody, even those who negotiated the agreement, acknowledge it's not perfect, but it does, for 10 to 15 years, depending on which part of the treaty we're talking about or the agreement, it basically halts the nuclear weapons program in its tracks. It puts time on the clock. It prevents Iran from being able to dash to a nuclear weapon. It gives us lots of transparency and higher confidence that we know what they're actually doing and whether or not they're complying. And oh, by the way, the International Atomic Energy Agency has repeatedly certified that they are complying with the terms of the agreement. So Iran is of great concern, not only because of its nuclear interest in nuclear weapons, but because of the destabilizing influence it plays throughout the Middle East. It actively seeks to undermine regimes. It actively threatens Israel through proxies like Hezbollah. It is playing a very counterproductive role in places like Syria, propping up the Assad regime, and so forth. The only thing worse than a malign Iran that's active around the region is a malign Iran armed with nuclear weapons that's active around the region. When you talk to, I was just in Israel, you talk to any senior Israeli defense official, and they will tell you, please don't walk away from the deal. The last thing we need is to, on top of Syria, on top of Lebanon, on top of Iran's activities, is to worry about them reigniting the nuclear program and us having to worry about that as an immediate threat. So I would say, let's keep, you know, it's not in our interest to walk away from this deal. And that says nothing about how we would be isolating ourselves diplomatically from the allies that stood alongside us to negotiate this in the first place.
Michael?
Just to add to that, of course we shouldn't leave this agreement because the alternatives are worse for the reasons that were just described. But I want to underscore that other people have a different view. It's not unlike the scenario you described with the summit with the North Koreans. We tried, it didn't work, now we're going to walk away, and there's only one option, military force. I think there's a similar scenario that some people like to talk about. We're going to get out of this, then they're going to start building up, they're going to do these other things, and they're going to say, well, now we've got to strike, because we're not waiting until they get a nuclear weapon. We have to take them out now. So I actually worry that this May 12th deadline is going to be an accelerator for some that want to propose military force. And I just want to keep underscoring how disastrous that would be. I'm not against military force per se. There are times in history where I think it was appropriate. There were times in the Obama administration when I thought it was appropriate. And I advocated for more military force on one occasion during the Syria crisis. But the theory here is just flawed. The theory that we're going to bomb Iran and they're going to stop trying to make nuclear weapons, the very thing, as George said, that prevented other countries from being attacked, is flawed. And just think about it. Iran, we know from polling data, I work on Iran, we have a project on Iran at Stanford. Iranians are a very proud people. Think about how you would respond if some country out of the blue attacked us. What are you going to do? You're going to blame Trump for that? If you're an anti-Trump person, you're not going to blame Trump. You're going to rally behind the flag. You're going to even rally behind these horrible mullahs because you were just attacked for reasons that you think were inappropriate. And that's the world we'll be in if we attack Iran today.
China. Now that we have another emperor in the world.
This is an easy one, right? China.
Did we underestimate President Xi? Will that result in consequences in terms of the relationship between the United States and China?
I'll take a stab at the indirect. I do think we underestimated Xi, and that I think he has surprised even most China watchers with the speed with which he has consolidated his power internally, and the degree to which he has set himself up, as you put it, to be sort of an emperor for life. The other thing that he continues to do remarkably well, which is very, very disturbing and doesn't get much attention in the West, is that he is constructing the modern surveillance state. If you are a Chinese citizen today, you are given I can't remember if it's called a loyalty score or a good citizen score, but it's basically like getting a credit rating, except it's based on your behavior as a citizen. And so it involves monitoring all of your calls. It involves monitoring your social media, your participation on social media, what things you read, what your neighbors say about you, what you're upset, you know, the family members that don't like you say about you. I mean, it is a massive intelligence collection approach that is highly subject to being manipulated. And it determines where you get to live, whether you get to travel, what kind of job you get. And it's the most Orwellian thing I have ever seen in the world. And it is being constructed right now in China under Xi's leadership. And that is exactly how he's going to maintain political control, even as the economy grows, becomes more integrated, et cetera. So we should not underestimate this man.
Are tariffs a good way to balance trade? You know, let me expand.
Yeah,
let me expand on that. Is a trade war good for the United States? We've been through this before. We've imposed tariffs on steel and then put them back on. We've been through Smoot-Hawley and saw the consequences of that in terms of protectionism. But at the same time, we have a trade imbalance with China. And other countries as well. Are these tariffs going to work, or are they going to impact on our economy in the wrong way? George?
Well, first of all, the tariffs on steel and aluminum are a cut in the U.S. defense budget because it will effectively buy less now because steel and aluminum are important components of defense materials, and they will cost more. Who cares about a trade? I have a chronic, incurable trade imbalance with my barber. No. Every 3 weeks I buy a haircut from him. He never buys anything from me. And he has a terrible trade imbalance. He lives in Washington, and he has a trade imbalance with Iowa because he eats corn products, and Iowa never buys a haircut from him. Somehow it works out. I mean, it is... Big, bossy government never gets bigger or bossier than it does when it is protectionist. That is the government selling the American people what they can buy and what quantities and at what prices. Where did we get the idea the government is good at this? Now, with regard, the steel and aluminum thing is mind-boggling. The government is doing this because we have a national security problem. That is, they're saying that getting steel and aluminum, vital materials, inexpensively from a variety of sources is a threat to our national security. It makes your head hurt. Because the president is convinced that trade is a zero-sum game. The fact is, trade definitionally only happens when both sides are happy. Now, the president has, before he did this, the president stood like Horatio at the bridge to stop an influx of Korean washing machines because Whirlpool went to Washington and said, we are not making as much money as we wish we did because the Koreans are sending us prettier, cheaper, and better washing machines. Therefore, we want you to impose a tax. A tariff is a tax paid at the border. We want you to tax the American people to give Whirlpool more money. This is not a sensible way to run a country and has nothing to do with national security. And it betrays a colossal misunderstanding of international trade. If Mr. Trump's objective is to shrink our trade deficits, we know how to do that, have a good, solid recession. Because our trade deficit shrank in the 1970s, which was the decade of stagflation, when the economy was sluggish and we didn't import all that stuff.
There's some good news here.
But just to code it to this conversation, there is some good news about the China relationship with the United States precisely because China succeeds in the world by being part of the system. Russia is a rogue state. Russia is outside of the system. I used to sit across the hall from the people that worked on China when I worked at the White House, and I always admired that they had so much going on that it prevented, our boss used to say, don't do stupid stuff. It prevented that bilateral relationship from doing really stupid things. Now, we know in history that that's not always true, but the ballast that gives, I think, is a positive piece of the China-U.S. relationship that we don't have with the U.S.-Russia relationship.
But two things, if I could just say, you talked about the surveillance state they're erecting. Administrations of both parties have wagered on two ideas that turned out to be false. The second one was totalitarian regimes depend on intellectual autarky, sealing their populations off from the world, and the internet would make that impossible. Turns out the tools of the internet enable this kind of control. But before that, for 40 years approximately after Nixon went to China, we made a bet on, I'll call it the Starbucks theory. Give the Chinese a choice of 15 coffees, and they're going to want at least two political parties. The belief was that if you have a market society and capitalism, which requires a judiciary to adjudicate contracts, you will import surreptitiously the rule of law and a kind of permeation of society by fair dealing and information and all the rest, because in theory, you couldn't have an authoritarian, efficient market society. So far, we're wrong about that. Now, I happen to think, I'm getting an ambassador's expertise here, but I think the Soviet Union died of ignorance. That is, it didn't know what anything ought to cost. So they made shoes that were examples of value subtraction. The shoes were worth less than the materials that went into them. It's not easy to do. Only a Marxist could do this. But so far, China has made a success of combining authoritarianism with a reasonable, efficient allocation of capital. Yeah. So we've bet on two ideas.
But I think he's made a big mistake, President Xi. I mean, the other beauty of that system is that they had a system of transition, of rotation for their leadership. And the data, sorry to sound like a political scientist, but we study authoritarian regimes. The most stable authoritarian regimes are those that have that, one-party states. The least stable regimes are, one-person rule. And I think he's made a real mistake. Maybe they wanted one party, and if he's weakening that one party and the informal rules that they have, I think he may have stepped too far.
Also, I was pleased to see the other day, they said he's chosen the man who will run the economy. Any economy that has a man running it is going to fail. I don't care if it's Adam Smith, it will fail.
Okay. What does the end of the war in Afghanistan look like to you? Where are we with Afghanistan, and how long is this thing going to go on? Michelle, you've been dealing with it for a long time.
Yes, I've been dealing with it for a long time. So, you know, I think we do have a long-term and persistent objective in Afghanistan, but it's a fairly narrow one, and that is to prevent it from returning to being a safe haven for terrorists that could launch attacks against us. The good news is there's been lots of progress in things like the economy, girls' education, the quality of health care, and importantly, the Afghan National Security Forces in terms of them actually doing most of the fighting with us enabling their support. The problem is that the Taliban is still quite resilient, and they have actually regained a lot of territory in the rural areas, not so much in the cities. But this, we are fighting in a stalemated situation. And there's no way that either side can win on the battlefield, in my judgment, and the judgments of lots of people who look at this closely. We used to believe that we had to get to a near-defeat situation with the Taliban before we could actually go into negotiations that would, you know, resolve the conflict, you know, through political means. I think that's never going to happen for either side, and so now it's a case of, how do we transition from basically a dynamic stalemate on the battlefield to some kind of political process? I actually think the Afghan unity government has made a pretty courageous move recently, which the support of all, pretty much the support of all parties, have said, look, no preconditions. We want to have peace talks with the Taliban, and they've invited them to the table. So far, the Taliban said, we want to talk to the United States, but not the Afghans. But we'll see where that process goes. It's going to be very, very difficult. You're going to end up reconciling some, having some Taliban enter into the government and the process eventually. But there will be a hard core that, with sanctuary and support from Pakistan, will remain in the game. And so, long term, we're going to have a counterterrorism problem in the South Asia. And so I do think there's likely to be long-term cooperation between the U.S. and Afghanistan in that context. I don't think it will be the U.S. forever defending the viability of the central government. But at least that's going to be what it is for a while. They are not ready to stand on their own. We should have no illusions. If we left today, within a year, Afghanistan would be back in civil war.
George, you've written about this. What do you think happens in Afghanistan?
I think the American people have been amazingly tolerant of this. We're a casualty-averse society, which does us credit, and the casualties are low, which is important. We have already been in Afghanistan, fighting in Afghanistan, more than four times longer than we were involved in the Second World War. But this is on the periphery of America's thinking, and they'll put up with a lot. They'll tolerate this. The problem is, I sat in what was to become your office in the Pentagon with Secretary Gates, and I said, when is the last time Afghanistan had a government whose writ ran across the country? Without hesitation, he gave a terse answer. He said, never. And I don't think we should, if we're holding out for that to happen, the answer about when we'll come home is never.
Interesting. Yeah. Do you think we'll have a U.S. presence, a force presence in Afghanistan for a long period of time, similar yes. to our presence in South Korea?
I think, yes. I think for first and foremost, as a long-term kind of counterterrorism hub, given all of the groups in the region, it's in our interests to be meeting them there rather than waiting for them to come here. And I do think in some areas, you can't build an air force in 2 years. it takes 20 years to build an air force or whatever. I mean, it's going to, the advise and assist and training mission is going to take time until they can fully stand on their feet. They will be able to fight. They are. They are leading the fighting, very in many cases quite independently. But the sustainment, the logistics, the equipping, all of that stuff is something that's institution building. That takes time to build militaries that are self-sustaining in that way.
Yeah. Interesting question here. What legal authority does President Trump have to wage a preemptive or preventive war against North Korea?
None. No, I mean, It's one thing to say there's a gray area, and God knows there are gray areas about when the nation's threatened and what constitutes hostilities and all the other terms in the War Powers Act, but to go from a standing start, coolly, without intelligence saying that we are in imminent danger of attack, which is to say to wage a preventive war, not a preemptive war, not trying to preempt something that is an imminent threat, if that doesn't implicate Congress's power to initiate hostilities, then we have effectively, through inaction and inattention and sloth on the part of Congress, we have amended the Constitution.
And short of that, though, let's just be clear that the U.S. Congress is not playing the role that that is embedded in the Constitution, but I think just for a democracy on foreign policy issues. It is across a lot of domains, I would say that we're not at a place when we have real, I just realized I'm sitting next to a congressman.
Former. You,
former. I actually would
just don't talk about my son.
I hear he's doing really well. And you should be very proud. But he's on the Ag Committee, right? Not Foreign Affairs. Rightfully so. To be honest, I'd like to hear your views on this. I mean, that's my impression. I deal with a lot of members of Congress. Atrophy there.
I agree with you. Look, we went into 9/11 took place. We got authorization based on 9/11 to do the things we did going after Al-Qaeda. Since that time, Congress has not been able to develop any kind of revised authority, even though presidents have asked for it, that Congress could not agree. And the result is that Congress has basically abdicated to the president, because frankly, president as commander in chief can decide on the basis of national security to conduct an attack. That's what presidents can do. And unless Congress is willing to step forward and develop some boundaries for that kind of power, then presidents will still, they'll use the 9/11 provision as an excuse for whatever they do. And I think it's just a dangerous time. But it's dangerous because, frankly, Congress is not willing to exert the leadership
exactly
that it should exert when it comes to the use of power.
Is
climate change, Michelle, you dealt with this, is climate change viewed as a threat to national security?
I would say among practitioners, the answer is yes. One of the first institutions to take climate change seriously was the United States military, because you had people looking at our basing infrastructure around the world and saying, my God, if some of these projections, even the modest projections, are correct, I'm going to have ports and facilities and bases underwater. How am I going to deal with this? They also understand that the military also understands that if you have more frequent, more severe weather events, the military is going to be called on to do more humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, tsunami, relief operations, and so forth. So just as a matter, and it's also planning culture. It's a strategic planning culture. It's an organization that looks 10 to 20 years into the future so that it can figure out what to procure and prepare for today. So all of that makes you very, very pragmatic and clear-eyed. And if the facts are there, there's not a lot of ideology involved. You know, if the fact base is telling you this is going to be a contingency, you start preparing for it. And I think that mindset has been very much the bedrock in the U.S. military, and that's sort of, I think, affected others in the development assistance world who are looking at the resilience of communities or lack thereof, and so forth. The application of ideology is really more of a political phenomenon. It's not as much of an issue among the people who will actually be tasked with dealing with the impacts.
U.S. Pulled back from the Paris Agreement on climate change. Looking at at climate change and steps that can be taken to deal with it. Give me your sense of whether or not you're hopeful or you're discouraged in terms of the future on climate change.
I'm cautiously optimistic because I think there has been a sea change in our country, despite what the president says, and in the world about the necessity to take this issue seriously. Now, how to do it, whether government should do it or not, as we discussed with the students earlier today, I'm a little less optimistic that the governments will solve it, but I'm quite optimistic that the private sector will take this seriously. I live in the Silicon Valley. I have lots of friends involved in this. They've been involved for 20 years, by the way, not just recently. And if you look at how those markets are changing, it makes me cautiously optimistic that we'll get ahead of this in time. And I'm also cautiously optimistic about the Chinese debate. We have a campus in China, Stanford does, so I go there fairly often. And there are teams working on this, and they've now decided for their national interest, not for some norm, but for their own national interest, for their own stability in their society, they have to engage with this. So I think a combination of maybe states, the markets, and the NGOs and people that continue to make this an issue, it's one of the, you've had a pretty negative list, so if climate change is here, that's the positive one. That's pretty bad. We're not going to die right away. We can wait for our grandchildren.
George, do you think we'll be able to deal with climate change?
If there is climate change, yes. The I happen to believe that the certitudes entertained by the policy community are not based on real certainties in climate science, that we're going to discover that solar activity does most of the climate change that we're worrying about. I think that 40 years from now, the world's energy mix will contain approximately today's percentage, which is about, 80% fossil fuels. Not the least of the ironies right now is that the reason the United States is doing so well in meeting its targets is fracking, in spite of the fact that Nancy Pelosi said that the American people should use more natural gas rather than fossil fuels. Again, we're going to learn. We're going to find out. A lot of dire predictions have been made, and we're going to find out because we're not going to do the things that the predictors say we should do.
But we're also interesting about 40 years. 40 years from now, you said it'll still be the.
I think so.
So why are there so many electric cars today?
And more coming.
What explains that then? Is that just because that we?
And how are we going to make that electricity?
There's lots of ways to make that electric.
There are, but you try and build a nuclear power plant in this country. Those electric cars are powered by gas, oil, and coal.
Okay, I'm gonna send you some data from friends of mine that are smarter on this than I am. I don't profess to be an expert. I know the numbers are moving in a different direction. I don't know if they've flattened out.
Let me ask you about another easy one. The war in Syria has been going on for 7 years and producing nothing but chaos. How is this going to end? Is Assad going to be the winner?
I think with Russia's intervention and Iran's support, I think Assad will govern some part of Syria, at least the part, the sort of some Alawite dominated part of Syria. Whether he'll govern the entire country, whether there will be greater autonomy devolved to local entities and communities. But, I like Mike Michael, was someone who argued for a more assertive response to the crisis very early on, when I think we had options to try to stop it from going all the way, devolving in the way it has. But those options are no longer on the table. The U.S. does not have substantial leverage. You know, the negotiations are happening under Russian auspices and UN auspices, and the US is barely showing up at the table. And so we don't have a lot of leverage to dictate terms. I think what the thing we have to focus on is making sure that Iran doesn't and its proxies don't end up right on the border of Israel. We need to make sure that Iran is not, you know, further strengthened in Syria. But I think that's going to be very tough. It will also be tough to consolidate the territorial defeat of ISIS in Syria if the fundamentals don't change in whatever resolution comes out of this, because ISIS came for a reason, back to Syria and to Iraq, and that was the marginalization of the Sunni communities. And unless you address that problem, and however things get resolved in Iraq ultimately and in Syria, you will have a recurring extremist, Sunni extremist terrorism problem.
Michael, could I just add one thing to that? I mentioned earlier that I finished writing it. It's coming out in May, a book about U.S.-Russia relations. But the longest chapter in that book is about Syria and our time in the government in Syria. And I read your book while I wrote that. Without question for me, that is the most tragic chapter of the Obama administration. And I'm part of it. And we made mistakes. We need to own that. I think there were alternative paths. And it's tragic. I think it's horrible what's happening there. There will be no peace with Assad in power. That I am convinced of. That was our argument to Putin for several years. But we made that argument analytically as if we were just political scientists looking at this, and Putin actually decided he was a player, not just an analyst. And so he doubled down. And so I think this is going to be with us for a long time. But I wanted to make a broader point, which is, now that I'm back in academia, I worry that we don't study non-events close enough. We always, in the government, I was always struck by, if we do this, then A, B, and C will happen in the first order, and then D, E, and F in the second order. And to his credit, I would say President Obama was very good about asking those questions, George, the kind that, then what? He was very good at that and very deliberative about that, and it was really impressive to me. The question we didn't ask enough is, if we don't do X, what are the other consequences and unintended consequences that come from our inaction? And as a social scientist, I think we don't study that enough. And I worry that, have we learned the lessons of our decision making on Syria? I looked hard. I didn't see any great studies of that. And I worry that we study events better than we study non-events. And I think we need to study both.
George, we got a short period of time, but on Israel and Palestine, is President Trump's decision on Jerusalem make it difficult to resolve that issue?
No more difficult than it already was, and arguably a little less difficult, because no one has any illusions anymore that Israel is going to divide its capital. But even just 10 years ago, people would say the Middle East is in turmoil and terribly dangerous place. The first thing we must do is solve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. Who today thinks that that's the biggest problem in the Middle East? The world has moved on.
Yeah. And so must we. We've had, obviously, a lecture that has dealt with a lot of the challenges that we're facing in our democracy. But I think the great hope in our democracy is that there are people like our panelists who think hard about how can we solve these challenges so that we can protect the American dream for our children. Thank you very much, and thank our speakers.